evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to the Cedar Hill City Council meeting. Today is Tuesday, March the 15th, 2016. I currently have 7:01 p.m. I'd like to call our meeting to order. Tonight's invocation will be given by Council Member Zapala and the pledge by Chandler Goodwin. Mr. Zapala, go ahead.
Our dear Heavenly Father, we're grateful for this great country that we live in this wonderful city. We're thankful for all the natural resources around here and the beautiful environment in which we live. We ask that Thou bless us this evening, that we might be able to make wise decisions, that we might be able to plan prudently for the future of our city, and that we might be able to come together to make collegial decisions and to have fruitful discussions. We ask these blessings in the name of Thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Mr. Goodwin?
Will the audience please rise? Please repeat the Pledge of Allegiance after me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Mr. Goodwin. Next item is the approval of tonight's agenda. So if someone would like to make a motion to accept the agenda as is or make amendments, then I will take that now.
When is the Planning Commission coming?
We've got two members here right now, and they are scheduled to be on item number 8.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering is if they were all here, if we should move.
Are
it,
more
no?
commissioners coming,
they
Chairman?
Were invited and those are that we're able to come here.
Just the two of you? Are you guys fine waiting for us to go through stuff, or do you?
Yeah, we knew those other agenda items.
Okay, well then okay. I would just move approve it as is.
Okay, I have a motion to take the agenda as is. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Mr. Zapala seconded it. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion was unanimous. Thank you. Moving on to public comments. I have one person who has signed our public comments. Public comments is where we allow anyone to come and speak about whatever's on their mind. They have 3 minutes to do this. This is time for them to say whatever they want. And then after that, and then the council will have time to debate and discuss ideas. So, Joe Filon, you are up. You've got 3 minutes if you want to give your address, and then the time's yours.
Thank you. My name is Joe Filon. I live at 4018 West Cypress. I'm here today to talk to you about City Ordinance 6-7-5. This ordinance states, and I quote, the provision, or this ordinance has to deal with signs within city limits. It says, the provision of this chapter shall be applied, it's called exemption from permit requirement is what it's called. The provisions of this chapter shall not be applied to regulate the use of traditional public forums as alternative channels of communication by the public, provided such use of for the free exercise of constitutionally protected activities. I'm here today to request approval of temporary signs to be placed on public properties to inform residents of which precincts they belong to and where they will meet for caucus next Tuesday. In my opinion, these signs fall within this exemption. It provides for the free exercise of people's constitutionally protected right to vote for their representatives. If this exception is afforded to all political parties holding caucus, I don't see there being a problem of having one party favored over another if it's applied equally. If you decide tonight to approve my request, I would also ask that you inform city employees not to remove these signs. I will instruct all precinct chairs within the city limits to remove these signs the day after caucus. Thank you.
Okay. Let's have a little bit of direction here if we can. So, Mrs. Reese, were you able to look into the language of the code, and can you give us some feedback?
Yeah, I was looking at it. I think we did this a couple of years ago when Daryl Acumen requested a similar exemption, and I David, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure we allowed it when Daryl Acumen came and asked for this kind of the same thing. But when I'm looking in the sign ordinance, it does say exempt temporary signage used for governmental purposes that is informational in nature or related to events, elections, recreation, or other city programming may be placed on private property or in the public right-of-way. It's limited to 3 feet in height, 5 feet in length. Can be posted no more than 14 days before the occurrence of an event and shall remain for no more than one business day after the occurrence of an event. No more than two signs shall be permitted in any location, and where said signage presentation does not block public right of way, disrupt the peace, incite to violence, or cause any other public disturbance. Such exception does not apply to the roundabout portion on Cedar Hills Drive, where signs shall be limited to one at any given time. So where we limit the roundabout to only one sign, I think we'd have to just refuse any signs there because we obviously couldn't have one for two different caucus meetings. But everywhere else, it looks like it would be allowed.
Well, that's why we said we could use that space on the right side where the city used to put.
Right, just not in the roundabout itself.
Yeah.
So would that work for you? And so I would suggest that if it's okay, we have staff reach out to who's ever in charge of the Democratic Party's caucuses and give them the same privilege that the council is giving you. Would that be okay?
Yes.
And so Mayor, council, is it okay if we give direction to have staff work with Mr. Phelan and whoever represents the Democratic Party and let them know that they can put up signs on public right-of-ways, public property, but not on the roundabout?
Is everyone okay? One comment on this. Is this the sort of thing that we ought to be revising our code so that this is a staff administrative decision and this doesn't need to come to the council?
Did what?
Revised it to accommodate this.
We did, but we didn't say who makes
it. It doesn't say who makes the decision. I think this is endemic with our code that we tend to say this is what should happen and that we don't state who has the authority to make that decision. And this is one of those decisions
where... Well, it's a question because in the past, the code enforcement... Jenny, who is it now?
Jenny.
Has removed them? Is that what's happened?
No, she hasn't removed political signs in the past because the issue here is it's allowed in the code. So there's not really any granting for staff to do this, and it's not really administered from staff because it is allowed in the code. What we will do is we'll reach out and help everyone put them in the right locations and make sure they understand the code that exists. So I don't know that there's really any
no action.
Action necessary tonight.
Individual politicians don't have this freedom to put it on.
Correct.
But you know, some, like voting nights, then that is in harmony. Now, are we still in agreement, or you want to say that we can put signs on? Is that what you're?
No, I'm totally fine with that. I think it's a great idea
to have no signs on the roundabout. Because that's what Jenny's saying. The language says.
Well, the sign code says one.
You can only have one sign.
But there's two parties.
That's my point. Right. So I would say that we just keep them off the roundabout and we'll be safe. But
I'm in total agreement with all this. I'm not arguing with anybody. Okay. I'm simply trying to make our job easier. That ideally he could have just come and talked to David, and David would have said, "Yeah, sure," and we shouldn't have these things come to the council.
Right. I agree with that.
Okay. So I'm not sure I agree with that. But I like things to come to the council so that we can weigh in on things.
Mayor, is there any way we can reword it so that they can use the roundabout? I mean, that's a big special.
That was quite a debate last year with residents.
Can I interject? Not in time for this event. This is a Title 10 land use code, so it needs to go to the Planning Commission first for any sort of rewording, which would then need a public hearing, which would then need to be noticed properly 10 days before, followed by a public hearing in the City Council another 10 days. Yeah. So you're looking at any sort of even minor change on this, you're looking at probably at least 2 months.
Okay.
So not in time for this event.
Mm. But it can still be on the sides.
Okay. Is that acceptable? Very good. So I think Council's given some direction there. And let's move on to our consent agenda. Looks like there is just one meeting's minutes. That is from the February 16th, 2016 City Council meeting. So someone who has had the opportunity to look at those minutes and would like to make a motion, I'll take that.
I move that we approve the consent agenda.
Okay, I have a motion. Is there a second?
I will second.
Mr. Cipolla seconded that motion. Any discussion? Let's have a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. Moving on to city business. Starting from my left, Mr. Bunker, go ahead.
Just a couple of items, Mayor and Council. Coming up on April 6th, 7th, and 8th is the Utah League of Cities and Towns semi-annual training and conference that will be held in St. George. If you're interested in that conference, please let me know. The Recreation Department will be adding two new events this year to Family Festival, pickleball, and a three-on-three soccer tournament for younger kids. More details will come. Put on your calendars the annual Easter Egg Hunt and Teen Easter Egg Hunt. Will both take place on March 26th, which is Saturday. The Easter Egg Hunt starts at 11 at the Heritage Park, and the Teen Easter Egg Hunt starts at 8:30 at the driving range.
Is that Friday night or Saturday night?
The teen one is they're both Saturday, one in the morning and one at night. Soccer, tot soccer, teen soccer, and t-ball registrations are all currently open, and the teen soccer closes this Saturday, so please let your friends know, let your teens know. More information can be found on the website, cedarhills.org. Golf is in full swing. We've opened the course. We just need some warmer weather than what we've had today to get people back on the course. We did have an emergency management town hall meeting. It was based on attendance the most successful one we've had so far. There were 423 people identified came through. This was a multi-city town hall meeting, and there were some, it was great information that was given to everyone who attended. So, and we'd like to really thank Laurie Peterson for her efforts there.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Isn't the teen hunt usually on Friday night before? Is there a reason why we changed it?
Yeah, it's an all week.
Oh. The only reason why I'm saying that is just because of the area we live in. A lot of girls 8 and older will be going to women's conference on Saturday, so they may not be able to participate on Saturday night, just as an FYI.
Afterwards.
Maybe so.
The party will still be going on after 8:30. Is that what you're saying, Greg?
Okay.
They just had some
limitations. Okay. That's all.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Zappala.
I don't have anything today.
Thank you. Mrs. Reese.
A few members of the Parks and Trails Committee have met with someone in the city who is interested in redoing the roundabout at Cedar Hills Drive as part of an Eagle Scout project. I talked to Chandler briefly tonight, and I know there are some concerns with the project because of the sheer number of utility lines that go through that roundabout and issues that surround making significant changes there. So we have a meeting Thursday night where we'll talk about it in some more detail, and I will let the council know how that meeting goes. And then Family Festival is going well. They're still preparing for that first week in June. And when we have a meeting, I will update you there as well.
Okay. Thank you. We had a finance committee meeting, and we have another one coming up. But I'm going to let Charles handle all of that, as he's making presentations probably most council meeting nights at this time of the year as we're going through the budget session. And we did have a Lone Peak Public Safety meeting, and we have another one this Thursday. So we've been primarily dealing with employment issues, and as soon as we start talking more about the budgets of Lone Peak Public Safety, I'll report that back, and in terms of what they're expecting. But that's it, Mr.
Mayor, real quick, on your Lone Peak Public Safety meeting, is that this Thursday or the 31st?
I thought it was on the 17th.
Let's double check that. I thought they had moved that.
Oh,
I'll double check and,
okay,
and let you know.
All right. So, Mr. Geddes.
So, I concur with the mayor's report on the finance committee. So, I was there for that. Utah Valley Dispatch had a meeting on the 10th. I was out of town, but I did speak with Chantel before the meeting, and other than a few minor things, there was nothing. I would have had the alternative 10 there, but they only needed someone to vote, and so I didn't get someone for that.
Okay.
But no issues there as far as I can report.
Thank you. Mr. Crawley.
I don't have anything this way.
Mr. Bailey.
Nothing to report.
Thank you very much, Council. Moving on to item number 7 now, which is a discussion item on the Water Sewer Fund and the Excise Tax Debt Service Fund. Mr. Lowe, go ahead.
Good evening. Let's get right into it. First, I just provide a breakdown of the last fiscal year and where the money is going in our water and sewer fund. It's a $3.1 million budget expense-wise, and so of that $3.1 million, less than 25% goes to wages and benefits. $534,000 goes to sewer charges from Timpanogos Special Service District. Almost $625,000 goes to debt service. One of the highlights from this last year was refunding the 2006 utility revenue bonds, which were partially refunded and paid off last month, which will save the city going forward $402,000. There was $294,000 in Rocky Mountain Power electrical costs, over $200,000 in water purchases, and there's an allocation from the excise tax bonds of $78,000 that pays for the public works building. $68,000 motor pool charges, $68,000 storm drain maintenance, and $66,000 in professional services. We had a well rehab for Harvey Well. We had a utility rate study by Bowen Collins update, and we also ongoing financial software from Cassell. And we have quite a bit meter maintenance going on and meter installations from Bridgestone. Okay. This first chart shows the historical cost for Timpanogos Special Service District. Our current year is the red dashed line. So
this is an extremely exciting presentation, obviously.
Yeah. Sounds like primary. Okay, we need to get the wiggles out, do something. So a couple years ago when the study was made, happened to be the highest year we've had on record. It's that, if you look at the June, that was 2012. Since then, it's kind of been about the same, at least the first half of the year, and the last couple years, it's kind of started to go up around January. Now, what's kind of strange about that is the charges tend to go up. You can see the first 7 months of the year, and then our usage is going down. And so David always contacts him about this time of year and says, what's going on? And then magically, it starts going down again.
On the previous one, I'm curious, do you know why the costs have doubled since 2009?
So, yeah, they raised their rates a lot, and a lot. David could testify to that.
There's actually been three rate increases since that time.
Did they buy some big property, or was there some decision they made that made it so that they need to raise a lot more money?
Yeah, the biggest issue was the plant expansion occurred. That was a $75 million project in itself.
That explains it.
And okay. Then the energy, the power cost to run the new plant far exceeded what we had anticipated.
Okay.
The most recent increase was 14%, I think, last year. 2 years ago. Okay. Now, one thing I wanted to show you was the impact fees we're getting in this fund compared to other cities. It's hard to read that from here, but if Cedar Hills is the very last city on the bottom, and it has this little sliver, it says $30,000+. The next smallest city is Alpine. They have $142,000.
And why is that? Because they're about the same size that we are.
We don't have any development.
That all comes from growth, and we are showing that we're the most built out of any of the other cities in the valley. So that's a big advantage when you have projects like sewer lines that need to be done or water projects, because they can use those impact fees for them, and we have to use user fees to pay for them, because our, as you'll see in the next chart, we don't have any impact fees yet. I think because the city grew so fast and had just a little space to do it, I don't think the adjustments that were needed for impact fees really happened as fast as they needed to happen, because so we had shortfalls on whatever Zions or Lewis and Young projected. This chart kind of shows what our balances have been the last 4 years. The blue bar is our water impact fees. The yellow bar that's negative is our sewer impact fee balance. 4 years ago, we used up our sewer impact fees to expand 4800 West, and that spent more money. The reason why it's negative is because we spent more than we had in impact fees. Since then, we've been getting little amounts of money, and the negative balance has been reducing. In the meantime, the water impact fees goes down each year because our debt service related to PI qualifies for impact fees. So every time we make a debt service payment, that balance goes down. As you can see, this last year it went negative. So we're out of water impact fees and sewer impact fees.
Looking at Alpine again, though, are our impact fees on par with theirs as far as what we are collecting when we per project?
Per house? Mm-hmm. You mean per resident?
Yes.
I don't know what they charge per house. I'm guessing that they're charging similar. I don't think there's that many companies that do them, so. Now, they might charge more because they have some bigger houses. I'm not sure how they do that. But I've never seen each other city study. I really think it has to do more with just the volume.
Okay.
So on this next chart, I make a comparison of utility rates. Now, some cities like Spanish Fork have other utilities besides the utilities we offer, like electric. And it's really interesting because they like collect $30 million in electric revenues, and then they have $27 million in electric expenses. So you don't know if that fund's being used to offset other funds or if they're saving for power plant expansions or what. But it's not always easy to tell just by the charges. But one thing we know is our fees include saving for capital projects, which these other cities don't necessarily have to do. One thing I found besides the impact fees that we are low on, so this is another chart showing the different rates. American Fork's the most expensive, and they probably have the most debt service related to PI, and that's probably the biggest factor for them. Another factor is some cities don't have to purchase as much water as us. Like Alpine can get a lot of their water without purchasing from CUP. They don't have to pump like us, so their electrical costs are less. So not only do we have to save up for capital projects, but we also we have higher debt service and higher electricity, higher purchasing costs for water. And that's just the way the city with its geography is going to always be, because we're on a hillside and we don't have a spring in our city. So the proposed increases for the revenue accounts, the water fee increases is $36,000 for water fees, $18,000 for storm drain, and $57,000 for sewer. And that's in line with the Bowen and Collins study.
Wasn't our cash balance for utilities getting high?
Yes. And we have several. Yes.
So why would we want to increase our fees if our cash balance is getting to the point that it's it's breaking the law, basically, if you get
to have a cash balance? You don't break the law in utility funds, in general fund.
Okay.
No, because if we didn't have any listed projects, yeah, we wouldn't want to. But I'm going to talk about some of these projects. And I'm not even sure the amount that we have listed is high enough, because remember, this is 2012 when these numbers were come up. And what I've discovered is just in the last couple of years, everything that we thought, a couple of years ago, it was 2014, it was more expensive than 2012. Everything's much more expensive than when we did this study. 2012 was kind of the low point of when you could still get maybe decent labor on construction. Now it's gone up every year.
Charles, so, in that study, there's an inflationary number.
There is.
What you're saying is that component does not match the rise in costs associated with these projects.
That's what I think. Yeah. I don't know if you think the same way, but they put in 3% inflation, but sometimes constructions increases faster than that.
Charles, you gave us numbers in when you said a $36,000 water fee increase, that's the impact on the budget. Do you have these numbers in terms of the impact for a homeowner? What's a typical homeowner going to pay? Or what percentage increase is it for homeowners?
Yeah, so I think it's about a few dollars a month, so about $36 a year.
Okay.
Colin, so what has the city done? One of the things we know that we've had high demand on our PI and our water, and so the city's tried to do some things in the last few years to counteract that. We had Hanson Allen Luce do a capacity study. We had a water conservation committee make recommendations and present them at a town hall meeting. A year ago, we had education of residents on water conservation committee findings through Facebook, emails, newsletters, city's website, and signs. Last year, we had watering day restrictions with fines. In the meantime, Harvey Well has needed rehabilitation, and that just wrapped up. And Cottonwood Well is in the middle of getting its motor replaced. So we're going to talk about what Bowen and Collins update involves and what they're recommending. So in the original 2012 study, it was a pay-as-you-go philosophy instead of just planning on issuing debt when things broke down. It was like, well, we want to have savings up so when we do need to do a capital project, we can pay cash for it. So that was the idea behind it. And with that, they proposed culinary water increases of 6.4%. They said the PI didn't need to change. Sewer rates increased 5.5%. Storm drain rates increased 6.5%. And so the average came to 3.7% to 4.3% a year. Now, well,
let me ask a question. Well,
sure.
If you can go back to the Bowen Collins utility rate update, we talk a lot about at some point maybe metering pressurized irrigation. Mm-hmm. What if we, instead of having rates remain flat, what if we had Bowen and Collins or some engineering group analyze what maybe we should charge in light of the fact that at some point we may need to meter and this may help us accomplish that? Just posing a question. Your thoughts.
I have some slides that are talking about that coming up, so I'd rather just...
I saw those, yeah. If you want to pick it up later, that's fine.
I'll just pick it up then, so I'm not... Bowen and Collins, a year ago, not quite a year ago, in May, had been working on updating our utility study that they had done. And one of the things that we wanted to look at was, is it cheaper just not to do meters? Or is it cheaper to do meters? And if we do meters, what is the least expensive way for the city to do it? Is it to save up for those meters to pay it off in 5 years or pay it off in 10 years? And so in this memo draft, they analyzed that, and the information came from a Weber Basin study, so just up north, on what happens when residents get meters on or secondary meters. And one of the things that's interesting is they had one part of the area that got secondary meters and didn't see necessarily a change in cost from that. And just from being able to see what they were using every month, they used 20% less just from actually seeing what they were using. Now, on the people that had meters and were charged a different rate based on usage, they saw them use 32% less. So that's kind of the assumptions that were used based on how it would impact Cedar Hills. So that's what this chart looks like. The top line is unmetered use by thousands of gallons per month. So you can see at peak in July, the average acre lot will use just over 60,000 gallons of water if they're not metered. The second line is for metered systems, and it shows them peaking at about 40,000 in July. The third line is the state's conservation goal. And I don't understand the last line. It has to do with evaporation or something. I'm not sure what it's talking about. But
I think that line is saying, like, if you could somehow water at the minimal optimal.
Okay.
To water and water enough that you wouldn't lose through evaporation, and it would also be the ground. Like, that's what
we equilibrium get. Point.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. So on that May memo last year, the first assumption was if it cost $1.5 million, and that was fully financed, so you pay approximately $300,000 each year plus interest, or what would be the impact if you did it over 10 years, which is $150,000 plus interest a year, or what would happen if you did no meters, or if you saved for the meters. So alternative one, looking at the cost, it was approximately $1.2 million to do nothing. Alternative two, it was five-year bond, it would cost $581,000. For a 10-year bond, it would cost $705,000. And to save up for the meters was $1.6 million. That's what this looks like in the chart. So the lowest cost one is the gray one, which is the 5-year bond. At first, you know, you're paying more up front each year, but then you see this, the savings in maintenance and electricity use in the faster than the other options.
Well, it could, I'm not sure how their numbers are derived, but it could, I mean, it could be quicker because, you know, the city in general will be using less water.
Yeah.
So what is the step up on the blue? Every, what, 5 years is a step up in cost? What does that represent?
Yeah, I think that, so, like, if we had a car that was driving 10,000 miles a year, and we had one driving 15,000 miles a year, and the one that was 15,000 miles a year doesn't seem like it's that much more, but they actually are driving it at like the highest RPMs at the red the whole time, while the person at 10,000 miles a year is more consistent because it goes, it's not limited to a certain amount of time.
Do you mind if I read from the study?
Darn, I'm sure, go ahead.
Sorry, it's in my blog already.
Sure, go ahead.
So this is what Bowden Collins says, Robbie. It says, aside from the smaller miscellaneous PI projects that would be required, the city anticipates the need for repair and replacement of several irrigation pumps over the planning window. Due to the additional wear and tear on the PI system from overconsumption, it has been assumed that approximately $300,000 of capital improvements would be required approximately every 5 years, beginning in fiscal year 2019, if meters are delayed or not installed. If PI meters are installed, capital cost for irrigation pump replacement will decrease substantially. It has been assumed that once PI meters are installed, approximately $150,000 of capital improvements would be required approximately every 10 years, also beginning in fiscal year 2019.
Yeah. So what they're saying is you run it harder, you're running it faster, you're going to have to replace things more frequently versus if you run it less hard, not as fast, you don't have to replace it as frequently. And that's kind of like with cars. I mean, you'll see the same thing at someone that babies their car versus running it into the ground.
And I guess regarding what Mike was mentioning earlier in terms of using less water, in terms of operation maintenance, the report says that over the estimated 20-year life cycle of the PI meters, the annual savings will total approximately $1.4 million.
So after we had gotten that information, there had been a discussion about, let's see what water restrictions can do. So we didn't really discuss this until we had seen how the water restrictions were going to be handled by the residents, if they were going to make a significant change in their lifestyle. We saw a 2% decrease, which we didn't feel was significant enough. So we went back to Bowen and Collins and said, okay, if... and we also had some well failures in the meantime. So we had them look at that. And so they came up with three different options based on the further information they had. You didn't see a huge change with storm rate or sewer rate increases. The options have to do with the water rates. And the first alternative is status quo, which is maintaining 6.4% annually through 2025 with no additional wells. Alternative two is new secondary meters that are paid off in 5 years at 2%, assuming a price of $1.5 million. Now, one thing that we changed from the May is we said, well, what if we use some of the fund balance that we've saved up, approximately $900,000, so the bond payments are smaller. And so they did it based on that, and the water fees would increase the same until 5 years when the bonds are paid off, and then there would be an 8% decrease to the rates. And then it would continue at the 6.4% after that. The costs, the city approximately $230,000 less than alternative three, because there's 33% less demand on the water, $70,000 in power savings per year, and $45,000 in pump and equipment cost savings per year. The alternative three was to add a well and the relating infrastructure, pumps, pipelines, and that was $3.5 million, which would require 8% the first year, 5.8% the second year, and then the 6.4% after that. So one of the things I wanted to show was just looking at water charges for other cities that have meters. There's two in Utah County. Spanish Forks had it the longest, and they're the least expensive. Saratoga Springs just added theirs last year, and this is based on the 31,000 gallons used during 4 months out of the year for PI, and then 8,000 of culinary use the rest of the year. But the
cities that don't meter are also lower than us, all except for American
right,
Fork, right?
Right.
So this makes it look like, you know, everyone that meters is less, but we're pretty much higher than anyone, whether they meter or not. But anyway.
Yeah.
So I throw that out there.
I think it's important that a lot of these cities that don't are, I explained some of the differences, but as far as I think it's the reason why I showed this is to show that it's not necessarily, I think there's this misconception that having meters is more expensive, and it's not necessarily more expensive.
Do you happen to have the rates before and after for those cities?
Well, I live in Saratoga Springs, mm-hmm. and I think we talked about this before. Your sister lives there.
She thought that it went up after.
They thought.
Is that wrong, or what do you think?
I've had bills of 83, 89 this winter. I use about 4,000 gallons a month. I use about 30,000 in the summer, and my highest bill was 110. So before that, I was paying about $100 a month. So for me, it went down, but other people, it might have gone up. But I didn't see it as a huge increase.
You have access to the utility rates now. I'm just wondering if you have access to the utility rates before they switched over to metered.
It's also hard to compare because they may not be factoring into their utility rates capital replacement. And so they may be undercharging and then, we'll bond when the time comes. So it's hard to make those kinds of comparisons directly.
Or they have a lot of impact fees.
They have a ton of impact fees coming in. So it is tricky.
Factors, yeah.
They did do something where they charged the residents for a year $10 more. Mm-hmm. And then before they switched to the to kind of build up, I think, a savings, and then they But they did a $20 million project. It wasn't just meters. It was they had to expand like wells and all this other infrastructure too. So, but I think it is interesting. I don't think that meters necessarily mean more expensive. It just depends. And some of that is Spanish Fork. They have their, like I said, they have their own electric company. Maybe they make it up on electric bills. I'm not sure, because they make like $3 million surplus every year just in electric.
So I have two questions on the PI system, and I don't, this might be for David, but first of all, the state has, I know, had some discussions that at some point they may decide to mandate PI metering. And from what I've read, they've acknowledged that if they did mandate it, that they recognize they would have to have some financial responsibility for those, the implementation. So have we talked to anybody at ULCT to find out what their feel is on where the state is at with mandating it and what they would participate in as far as the financing?
Yes. So I've spoken with the governor's office, I've spoken with ULCT, and I've also spoken with some legislators. So this is what I can tell you, is there is not a clear path to if and when the state is going to do this. So the governor asked for around $500,000 in this budget year to study water analysis, which would include metering secondary water. That doesn't mean if it's favorable that he's going to do it next year. And Utah League of Cities and Towns has a position that this is something that they want to push. And so Jody Hoffman from the league is taking the lead, if you will, in terms of interacting with cities and also the governor's office. And she and I have talked, and she knows that that discussions, if they were to start, she's going to include me in that. So, and then various legislators are very non-committal in terms of saying, yes, we are discussing it, but there has been no concrete decision of if and when this will happen and what it's going to look like.
One of the first steps that I've heard coming down the pipe is that the state will require reporting of all waters that are consumed. So right now we send a report in annually to identify the waters that we use for culinary purposes. The state would then require that, at least as a minimum, the cities to start reporting how much consumption they're using in their pressurized irrigation systems. And that would start to identify the amount of water that cities are consuming. It wouldn't necessarily require them to meter initially, but at least report what those numbers are.
Okay. And that's I think my biggest concern is just I hate to put our residents on the hook for even a 5-year bond if 2 years down the road the state says everyone has to do this and we're going to pay for 50% of it, and now we've already bonded for 100% of it. So that's one of my concerns. My other question is, I've actually had an interesting conversation with a resident about this, and he's expressed concern that he feels that with the way we bill now, where residents can receive an electronic bill and they just have bill pay that pays their bill, that people aren't going to really pay attention to that difference and it'll just automatically get paid every month and no one's actually going to reduce water consumption. So we haven't really impacted our water consumption at all. And I'm curious as to what Spanish Fork or Saratoga Springs says, if they've moved to more of an electronic billing system like we have, and if they feel like their residents are paying attention even if they are auto paying their bill each month. Other than you, because you're a finance director, so I know you're looking at your bill. But overall,
I know it comes up on Facebook when someone has a leak or something, because they're like, hey, mine went up this much. Did yours go up this much? You know, so it does come up. Some people.
Right.
Like my neighborhood has.
So I'm not sure there's a big difference here. I've talked to the same resident, too, and I've been thinking about this issue. I looked at what happens when I get my bill. And I get an email that says, here's the total amount. Mm-hmm. And I look at that and say, oh, yeah, it's about the same as last month, no worries. Or, wow, something's going on, I'm paying an extra $10. I better go look at my bill and see why that is. I don't think that's any different from getting a paper bill, where, again, I would have to open the mail and look through it and then start comparing numbers.
Well, but I think what he was saying, and maybe I'm not understanding our finance system right, but I think what he was saying is right now you can just have it auto-deducted from your account or your...
Yeah.
And so you may not...
No, mine gets auto-deducted, but I still get the email.
Yeah, you still get an email.
Right.
Saying here's the amount that's going to be auto-deducted.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. And because I agree. I do the same thing. We actually had something at our house and it increased by $15, which isn't a ton, but we noticed it. But I think his concern was how many people just delete that email and just they're just auto-paying. Yeah. Which I don't know. I don't know what that percentage is. And so that was his concern is what if we spend all this money, but we don't realize...
One thing that I noticed Saratoga Springs did, like, might be boring to you guys, but for like 5 or 6 months straight, they said, your utility rates are changing, pay attention. And it was on the front page every single month. And it was the same message every single month. And
so just a lot of education.
And so if you miss that 1 month, hopefully in 6 months you read it at least once. And so I don't think it was a surprise to anyone. And then they had something where they're like, if there's a leak with one of these new meters, contact us and let us know. They had to work out some bugs.
Go ahead.
I was going to say one thing that I've studied this quite a bit. I was been over this individually with you and city staff. What I'm seeing, though, is that I think we're going to get there inevitably with meters sometime. And I think the longer we delay, the harder it's going to be to swallow the pill. And so, I mean, I think, yeah, whether or not someone looks at their bill or whatever, I think that's irrelevant. I think we got to look with what's best for the city and, you know, for the city as a whole. And it's even if the governor in 3 years mandates every city got to put PI in the next 2 years or how long his mandate is, he would have to reimburse us for doing it. So I don't think it matters whether or not we paid for it up front or we get it mandated us in 3 years.
Well, I can't imagine them providing any funding that would come anywhere close to 50%.
No, I don't think it'd be anywhere close. I'd be a drop in the bucket, and they said find out, get a way to bond for it or something, but you got to do it.
I'm not sure what the language is going to look like. I would hope that the language would include something that says if you've already done it, then you'd get some sort of a reimbursement. I would hope so.
I would too. There's no guarantees, but there's no guarantee that he's going to mandate it either.
Well, and I agree with you that we have to do what makes sense for the city, but that's, I guess, what this resident is saying is if we don't actually realize any savings in water consumption, then it didn't do anything. It didn't help with the problem that we're trying to fix.
But I think it's been proven that when you do meter, the consumption goes down. That's in the study.
I think, and that's what, you know, Charlotte is showing here. I had the same concern you had, Jenny, which is that if the state's going to mandate this, then let's sit on our hands and wait and see if they do this. And then I've had other people at the league and at the governor's office say, yeah, you can do that, but think of it this way, which is that we're estimating the cost is around $1.5 million. So let's say we wait until the state mandates it. What do you think the cost at that point is going to be? Because the people that put in or sell, whether it's installation or whether it's the meters themselves, all of a sudden the cost is going to go incrementally higher because the demand just blew up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, your supply-demand equation is going to say that the cost, which is now $1.5 million, maybe 2.5 to 3 million. I have no idea. I'm just saying that it's going to be substantially higher if we were to wait until that's mandated. So,
you could argue the other way that a commodity as it has much more. You could argue the other way that as it becomes more of a commodity, the price could go down because more companies are trying to get that business, or more there's better ways to do it, or you know, that isn't necessarily always true. That just because the demand goes up.
Possibly.
Then the price goes up too.
Yeah,
that's possible.
Until we get actual bid, you know, we won't know what the number is, and we might be freaked out by the actual bid. I don't know.
Well, we also have a reserve that we can put towards
what,
it right now, which I think is.
And I think each year that we've studied this, it's the price has gone up each year that we've put it off so far.
Going back to an earlier conversation, so in the meantime, I looked at our financials and saw that we had about $2.3 million in cash in the utilities fund and about $700,000 of restricted funds. What are those restricted funds for, out of curiosity?
Usually
in the utilities,
it's money that's in trustee accounts. So when we're paying, we pay monthly on our utility revenue bonds, mm-hmm. and they hold that money.
Okay.
And then it goes to pay the bond every 6 months.
So it's nothing we could pull and use out for anything. So the 2.3 is what we're looking at.
Most of that. Yeah. We used to have some impact fees, but most of them have been spent. So so most of the restricted now is related to debt service that's left.
So we have almost a year's supply of cash in the utilities fund. Because we spend 3.1
for operations, but if you look at some of these projects, this is more complex than just we try to make it simple. We try to say, okay, on this, we're delaying some of these projects. There's a CCAP study that the city has to do in the next few months. If they say 4600 West, because of the new development that's going in, needs to be moved up, that could be 400,000, that could be 700,000, I don't know. That one of the problems we have, if you see Cedar Hills Drive, it's just starting to deteriorate. We don't want to fix Cedar Hills Drive completely, and then we have two of the roads on here are related to Cedar Hills Drive, 4600 West, and then on the next slide, there's Cedar Hills Drive sewer line. If we say, hey, we need to replace this road, we want to put the sewer in first. We will have over $1 million in sewer projects. And so it's a little more complicated. Having $1 million, $1.5 million, we can spend it really fast. That's the problem we have. We don't have impact fees coming in to do these projects. We only have what we're saving up each year. So
just one more quick question. We have talked about water metering for a long time, and so I fully recognize that we may not have a choice with everything that we're experiencing as a city. I think it's important to recognize it's not a decision that our residents are going to be behind. They're going to be upset. And so I would just like to make sure that if we feel like that's the only option that we have to fix the issue, that we're realizing that we're really confident it's actually going to fix the issue. And so another thing I would like to see is the study that Bowen and Collins performed where they state that there was a savings of 23% or whatever that was. They say it was I can't remember 30. What cities.
Oh, the West Weber Basin.
Yes. If they can send us that study so we can see where they're coming up with that figure, I think that would be helpful as well.
We should also ask Spanish Fork.
We have the study.
Can you email it to the council?
Chandler has it. He can.
I agree, Jenny. And then we should also ask Spanish Fork and Saratoga Springs to give us their water usage if they would, from year to year.
I had called them a couple of years ago, and they said their average resident and Spanish Fork used 30,000 gallons.
But I mean, before and after, did it?
Yeah.
What was the decrease once they used metering? And then another question I have is, there's everyone reacts differently. I mean, there's people that are watering way too much, and there's some people that are watering way too much that wouldn't care if their bill went up higher, they'd still do it. And there's people that are really cost conscious that would reduce, appropriately. And then there's people that are way cost conscious that would stop watering their lawns in the summer because they don't want to pay the cost. Or during July and August, they'd say, I can't afford to water enough to keep it green. I'm just going to let it die during those months or let it go, and then we don't look as pretty as a city. So there's intended consequences, unintended consequences, and everyone reacts differently. So it is a big decision.
At that point, it probably makes sense for them, if they're in that situation, to put in xeriscaping, which would preserve the value of their home and cost them less.
But that costs some initial investment too.
Right.
So you never know.
I did see that on one corner in my neighborhood. Someone just let their lawn go brown.
I'm not going to pay for that.
But Yeah, the HOA, I don't know, but almost every neighborhood in my city's HOA, and they can get in trouble that way. I mean, they can get a lien on their house if they don't have a landscape. So, yeah, there is unintended consequences.
That only affects a third of our city.
But, yeah.
But,
I mean, in general, the philosophy behind this is that if you are going to be water conscious, you can probably save more money than you're paying right now.
Right.
I mean, there's... So I don't think it's all a cost, and I know it's going to be a political issue, but there are a lot of people that will probably save money over what they are paying right now.
Yes.
And that's my take.
And that's what I would push for. I would want those people that are water conscious to be rewarded for that. I would not want to price it in a way that they would be paying more.
For me, what it comes down to is if we push the education and we help people understand that their water is now metered and that they can save money if they use less, we can sell them on the idea that, look, if we're all in this together, it saves the city $1.4 million over the next 20 years.
It does.
So that's, it's not like we're spending money. We're trying to save money here. We're trying to be prudent. We're trying to look to the future here. And we're spending a little bit of money up front, but lowering our long-term costs by quite a bit. And that should be a decision that residents can get behind.
I think the only problem with that is that we are such a transient city that 20-year savings doesn't mean much to a lot of people who are going to be here for a couple of years or renters. But I agree.
The alternative is to keep doing what we're doing and spending more and more on repairs because we're running the system into the ground.
Yeah.
And then taking the hit when things happen to break during the summer.
Yeah, then and now crisis mode.
Now you're really having
you're
a
really
crisis.
There's
I,
no,
I think if you take the amount of people who are upset over the fact that we might do PI metering will pale in comparison to the people who are upset if they find that we could have done metering, we could have avoided the crisis, but now we're in a situation where everybody's lawn dies over the summer because we have a bad collection of events happen.
You will have angry people, no doubt, that will try to vote you out. I but in my city, I don't know all the incumbents that ran that they won right after.
And well, I'm not worried about it.
And I think part of that is, you know, they realized it was a need. There was education out there, and the people that were conscious, it didn't kill them. It wasn't a bad thing for them. And
I remember 7 years ago when we turned on our water, our PI water, and no water came out. I remember how mad people were. Nothing compared to how upset people would be just by putting in meters.
But we can't pretend that if we do PI metering that the breaks won't happen during the middle of the summer.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's like saying if I
much less likely to
if I drive 10,000 miles a year instead of 20,000 miles a year, then I won't break down during a big trip. You know what I mean?
It's RPMs on the engine. Remember the analogy we used. If we're driving our system at a much lower rate, the chances of that happening are lower.
Right.
They don't go away to zero, but they're much lower.
And even if it does happen, it's much easier to manage. If all your wells go down, like last summer when we went on meters. Right when they started, three out of the four wells in my neighborhood went down. And they're like, I had water as much as I wanted. I didn't have to worry about it. Now, if we had been on the flat rate, I don't think that would have been true. I've been in Saratoga Springs when we had all that rain that 1 year, and like 3 weeks later, we had no pressure. And I was like, what's up with this city? They're so stupid, you know? So I've seen... It is much easier to manage us, and we can't count on American Fork. I think the city needs to be self-reliant, and so this is one way to improve that. But
well, and just another point I want to make, Daniel, when you say when the water ran out, I think one of the frustrations that a lot of residents are expressing that I'm hearing anyway is they feel like the city said, yeah, we have the problem, so we're going to go to PI and we're going to bond for this and it's going to fix all of our problems. And we did it and it didn't. And so now the frustration is now you want to get into more debt to fix a problem that you couldn't fix the first time that you went into debt. How can we be confident that this is going to fix the problem this time? And so that's a valid frustration that people are expressing.
I understand, but that's not the anger that I heard. The anger I heard was simply, what is up with this city? We don't even have water coming out. We're not analyzing. Like, you told us you would fix this and it didn't. I mean, because I didn't recall that conversation ever being had with residents.
You know, I don't remember the argument being made when PI was being put in, because I was around, but and I may have missed it, but I don't remember the argument being made that it was going to solve our pressurized irrigation issues. It seemed as if, from my perspective, it was a way of reducing the demand of culinary and making sure that our two wells always had enough water to provide culinary. And so, but it could have been something else.
Yeah. I mean, I was here during that time too, and that's how I remember it. I don't think it wasn't like this is going to solve all our problems. It was like, yeah, now we don't have to chlorinate and treat as much water as we've done in the past. So you're not dumping all your treated water on your lawn. Here's a chance to...
At a flat rate, though.
Yeah, weren't they saying,
as much as you wanted for a flat rate.
Exactly. $10 and you can have as much water as you want. Yeah. And then we find out, if people think they can use as much as they want, then they're going to overuse and we really don't have as much as... we don't have enough for everyone to go crazy.
That's the problem with it. I mean, that's not the capitalist way.
Yeah, I mean...
The capitalist way is to pay what you get. I mean...
No, I agree with that.
The argument that I hear from residents, and I hear it over and over, is that, we were promised... a flat rate, right? But man, what would you do if your power was a flat rate? Would your air conditioning go down in the summertime and your heating go up in the winter? Absolutely. What about gas? If your gas is at a flat rate, and you won't, no matter how much you use, what would you use more in the winter? Of course you would.
I completely agree with that, and I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying I think it's important to recognize the frustrations that residents are expressing with this move, and I want to be really, really confident that if we do this, it's going to fix the problem.
Well, there's no guarantees.
I know there's no guarantees, but I want to be really confident.
I wouldn't ever promise that. I would say it's improving the situation. To say that one thing fixes things, I mean, that's... It's only improving the way we can manage it, and it's going to reward those people that are more conscious about it. I mean, and to me, that's really fair. I mean,
there might be people out there that don't care if their monthly bill went from $14 a month to $90 a month. They don't care.
Yeah.
That's fine then.
Yeah.
They're not going to be in here complaining.
So let's look at the studies and see where that leads us. But the studies clearly say that metering helps reduce your demand. The Water Conservation Committee clearly said
recommended it.
Yeah, that their only long-term solution is to meter. The state appears to be heading in that direction. So I'm not sure doing nothing is really the smartest thing to do. So. I my mother-in-law lives in Spanish Fork, so she told me when this happened, all the elected officials that were there that did this got voted out of office. But I always think leaders lead. You know, you do the right thing, and if you get voted out, so be it. And we shouldn't worry about that. We should try and make the best decision that we can based on the information that we have, and. I've tried to get the residents involved with this. I've talked about it a lot to the point where some people want me to stop talking about it. And I did for a while, thinking that the state may do something, so sit on our hands and wait. And then other people are telling me now, you sit on your hands and wait, and you're going to end up paying a lot more than what you're going to pay right now. So this is a good discussion to have.
I dislike the implication that anybody at this table is making decisions based on how residents are going to vote in the next election.
I hope not.
I think everyone here is trying to do what they feel is best for residents based on the feedback we're getting from residents.
Hear, hear.
Yep. I don't think there's anyone saying anything otherwise.
Well, I heard two people say now you might get voted out. That's not what I think any of us are concerned about. It is what do we do for our residents based upon the feedback that we're getting. I think that's what – I just want to make sure that everyone – we know that we're all trying to do our best based on what we think is best.
I don't think there's any debate about that. Okay.
Okay. So all of these projects, the timing changes, they were part of – the original study, and so most of these relate to sewer, and we know that we've delayed the Canyon Road sewer because one That was the one that we've talked about in the past, because one third of it is our residence, two thirds Pleasant Grove, and that's. But the other ones are all completely our residents, and if they reach capacity, we will have to be ready to widen the pipes on those. And I think the numbers on these are all probably low, since it's been 4 years since those original numbers came out. Other projects had to do with Harvey Well chlorination, Cottonwood Well chlorination, Cedar Hills Drive sewer upgrade I talked about. So, and sewer outfall line extension. Can you explain that again, David? I'm not.
So, American Fork and Cedar Hills, we've had a great relationship through the years. But we do not have a Timpanogos Special Service District outfall line that comes to Cedar Hills. So we are reliant upon the city of American Fork to convey our sewer. We have three discharge points from our city that go through lines in American Fork until it hits about, I want to say it's like 300 north in American Fork on the hospital road. That's where the TSSD main line comes to, and that's where a meter is. So as our sewer demand increases, as we send more flow through American Fork, it's our obligation to upsize those lines in American Fork, those outfall lines, so that we can convey our sewage through American Fork to that point where it hits a TSSD outfall line. Now, we have been working with American Fork for many years doing that. And every time there's a development in their city that's in between Cedar Hills and the outfall line, we coordinate with them to upsize sewer mains. And that is to ensure that we have capacity to take that our effluent down to a TSSD discharge point.
So the new Patterson homes, they're going to probably flow into that, right?
I need to check on that one. It might be just a little bit east of there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Some changes from 2012 is a vacuum truck, and we've added the storm drain improvements for the golf maintenance building of $100,000, and we've had to move up when the ponds get repaired, pumps get repaired for pond 10 and 12. We've also added on the schedule the Harvey Well getting replaced. This isn't a rehab. This is like drilling wider, deeper, totally replacing the well.
On the canyon road improvements, is that just because that's the soonest the county will let us? Do we know when they're going to be doing their resurfacing? Because I know we can't touch it for, 6 years after that?
Yeah, they usually have a moratorium on there. We don't know exactly when.
Okay.
I reached out to the county engineer multiple times this last week, and I have gotten no word back, so I don't know where they're at on the status of Canyon Road.
Okay, so before I go into this next slide, so for the Water and Sewer Fund, I don't have anything budgeted as far as PI meters right now. So if that's something that the city wants to go for, pursue, we would do a bid, and we would budget adjust at that time with the financing and the cash we have on hand. But there's nothing at this time that would change on the revenue side or on the operating side because of that. So, I wanted to go into a little bit. I have a couple of funds that I'm going to talk about besides the Water and Sewer Fund, and I wanted to provide you the definition from GASB that I know you all wanted to read from GASB Statement 54. So, a general fund. It's kind of a catch-all fund sometimes. But GASBE also created other funds, special revenue funds, debt service funds, capital projects funds, so that kind of the volatile types of items or the unique types of items could, or things you wanted to isolate could be separated from the general fund. So it says the general fund should be used to account for and report all financial resources not accounted for and reported in another fund. So it's just kind of your basic operating fund, and it captures everything you don't want to put somewhere else. Special revenue funds. We have just one special revenue fund right now, and that's the golf special revenue fund. And we have used that to account and report the proceeds of specific revenue sources. In this case, it would be green fees and other golf-related revenues that we committed. Those aren't restricted fees, but we've committed them to that fund. And that's our current special revenue fund. Special revenue funds, it says at the bottom, are not to be used for other purposes like debt service and capital projects. So if golf incurred some, it has some debt, we don't put show the debt service in that special revenue fund. If we do a capital project related to golf, it would happen out of the capital projects fund. Capital projects funds are used to account for and report financial resources that are restricted, committed, or assigned to expenditure for capital outlays. So we have a lot of our impact fees, like park development, straight impact fees, come into this fund. We have care tax come into this fund now, and it's used for capital outlay, acquisition, or construction. So that's what capital projects funds. Now, right now, we have excise tax debt service being paid out of our capital projects fund, which is weird. So excise tax debt service bonds paid out of the capital projects fund. And I think what originally happened is they just said, hey, this project, we're budgeting for the project in this fund. Let's just put the debt service in there too, and it's all there. But that's not really appropriate. So one of the things I'm proposing is having the excise tax bonds being in its own debt service fund for budgetary purposes. Debt service funds are used to account for and report financial resources that are restricted, committed, or assigned to expenditure for principal and interest. So the proposal is to move the debt service for the Public Works Building into its own fund for budgetary purposes, and then when I do financial reporting, if you've ever looked at like the state's financial report, you only see like 6 or 7 funds. They really have like 150 funds, but they consolidate them all into groups because for reporting it makes more sense to do that. But for budgeting, you like to see things isolated more. And so that's why we'd isolate it for the budget, but we'd combine it for reporting. Alternative for, so the other fund has to do with litigation. And if we are in a situation at your end where our reserves are low in the general fund and we still see litigation in the horizon that's not very cheap, one of the alternatives we have is to create a government immunity fund, which can track these volatile type expenses. And we can set that up with its own levy. Now, that levy isn't very big. It's 0.0001. So maybe the general fund or whatever would still have to transfer money into it for all litigation, but it could help management and track it and isolate those litigation costs. And I'm only really recommending this if things are bad at your end. So right now we have spent 67% of the $300,000 we budgeted through February. So we're right on track for 8 months, but if we were to go to court, I think the cost would accelerate a lot. So
if I understand from your presentation, it looks like the maximum amount we could do would be about $42,000.
Yeah.
This year, the state legislature passed a new law, a statute regarding cities bonding for judgments. And I haven't had a chance to read through all of the updates. And maybe that's a question for David Shaw, but how would that impact this?
Well, I think in the past, you had to use operating funds and negotiate terms up to 10 years maybe. And now you can actually say, okay, it's $2 million or is it $2 million or more?
I think so, yeah.
So if you have a settlement over $2 million, that's a lot for a city just to say. So I don't, it might be an advantage to the city. It seems like it seems worse for the city in some ways, because if they knew you couldn't bond for it, it seems like there's a limit to what you could pay.
But I think the legislature, as I read it, I did it, at least the summary I read it.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they said that you don't have to, the city would only have to pay what they can pay.
And yeah.
Divided over the amount of time that's reasonable for the city, in a nutshell. Is that, am I correct?
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
We're a small city.
Yeah, I think no pun intended, but the jury's still out on the ramifications of the legislation.
Yeah.
But I'd be happy to give you a briefing on that.
I would love a summary, yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah, even if you can only pay what you can pay, I'm worried that, if they stretch it out, plus you're paying interest now, where maybe the original terms, I don't know. I mean, it's good to have options in some ways, but it also gives the settlement people something that they can work with, and I don't know if that's good or not. A lot of these bills, there's over 400 bills or something that they're going through now, so I suspect, and I said this in my management update, that in the next few months, I hope the Utah State Auditor and ULCT will give us some good information on which ones affect us, because it's pretty hard to understand that language and all the impacts. And a lot of it's on how they enforce it, too, because you can have code in there, but if they don't interpret it the way you do, then it doesn't matter, So... So I think this was brought up last time, is what rates we can show on our when we send our bill to the residents. So those, right now we have a general purpose rate and we have a interest debt service rate for the GO bonds. Other cities might also have a city library rate or a immunity rate. Okay.
So a library is called out specifically there, as opposed to, say, a pool or some other city facility.
Yes, Highland, I believe, does that. And for Salt Lake, cities and Murray and Salt Lake City do it, and then Salt Lake County does it for all the other cities in Salt Lake County. So,
any questions for Cheryl? Thank you very much, Cheryl. Let's move on.
Okay.
Next item. And our commissioners left.
I'm going to go back real fast. Let's just tell them we finished without them.
Okay.
Are the updates in that Dropbox?
Our last item is item number 8, which is a discussion on temporary zoning ordinance and completion of timeline for general plan. So
it's in our email, though, right?
Yes.
We've been working on the language of the code, the design requirements, and the general plan collectively. And I think Mr. Shaw is prepared to give general comments tonight. And Reed Bromley's not here, so he will not be here to give any comments. But we do have some of our commissioners here tonight. Mr. Thomas, thank you for being here. Mr. Dredge, thank you for being here. Commissioner Driggs, thank you for being here as well. And so we are going to have a discussion about the language. Have you guys had an opportunity to view the language that we've come up with so far?
Yes.
Thank you. And so we've been trying to meet on most Thursday nights in order to come up with language that is up to date and applicable for where our city is today. So I think, Mr. Zappala, you had just some items you want to talk about, and you want to lead us off?
Yes, that's a good idea.
Can I just mention that John and Steve have to leave in 30 minutes? So
I will be brief.
So I just like, whatever feedback they have, I'd like to be sure that you're able to give.
Thank you.
Sure.
We'll be sure to leave plenty of time for them. I'm just going to...
Can I make a suggestion? You guys are far away from mics. And so either when you have something to say, walk up there, or if you're comfortable, pull your chairs up and then steal one of our...
There we go.
That'll work, Greg. Okay. So you guys now have a mic for when you want to say things so that the people that are listening at home in some future point can hear what you guys are saying. Daniel, go ahead.
Okay. So I'm going to give you just a brief 1 or 2 minute overview of what we've done, just to orient you to kind of our purposes and where we're at with this. So the document that you have right now is our complete overhaul of the document that used to be called the Design Guidelines for short. One of the first things we did was rename them requirements to help settle some of the confusion we've had as whether these are requirements or guidelines. Our legal team has told us all along they were requirements, even though they were called guidelines because they were adopted in the city code. I have mostly gone through this document and tried to remove language that was superfluous, but I'm not done yet. In other words, if you compare this to city code, you would see city code is just very factual, like here's the rules and regulations, whereas this has a lot of statements like this is the purpose of this code, and we're opining about whether parking is good or not and whether landscaping is good or not, and I'm trying to prune that language down and kind of still in the middle of that. But what we have right here right now is an introduction section that is and a community vision section that are mostly unchanged from the existing document. A little bit of the language cleaned up. I got an email that David sent me from Jeff Dodge with some suggestions that I thought were really good. Yes, there's some of that language that still needs to be cleaned up regarding what we call our zone and
can I interrupt that?
And
is
so
that
on.
The document that Dave sent over? That's collective from the...
No, that's just Jeff.
That's Jeff's.
Oh, that's just Jeff. Oh, okay.
Yeah. In Section 3, you're going to see that I put in a place called districts to show the different districts, and I thought it was easier to just call them districts instead of sub-districts because they were not subdividing any other districts, trying to clean up that language. The boundaries that we're showing there are kind of changing the neighborhood retail district to take into account the fact that we have a Walmart. And since that's a high-intensity use, we probably ought to put that in the high-intensity zone, whereas previously it was split between a couple of zones, as well as trying to align the boundary between the neighborhood retail and the mixed-use office retail with where the road is going to come in across from Walmart, and with the intention being that we ought to be really careful and really sure that our commercial zone is used there on both sides of that road. That would be primarily commercial property and willing to have that be high intensity property. So if you picture the driveway in the middle of Walnart's property coming down, there is a road that will come down there. I believe it's called 4700 West.
Roughly.
Is the idea of what that road would be called.
I think that's in.
It's started to go in.
Yeah. But the alignment,
I mean, it's stubbed out. Yeah. I moved all description of those districts to this section to explain the purposes of what those districts are for. And then section 3.2 is substantially changed from when you guys last saw this as a planning commission, but there is now a use table there. It's modeled after Pleasant Grove's and Provo's use table using the same categories. We're going to adopt a land use numbers document that is a separate document explaining what each of these numbers are in the table, and then putting in a P or a C for permitted versus conditional uses. The idea being that a permitted use is a use that we would expect would be approved without conditions that need to be substantially mitigated due to that use coming in. And you'll see we mostly have put things permitted in the neighborhood retail zone with more conditional uses closer to where homes would be in the mixed-use zone to mitigate impacts. You will see some question marks in that table because we still have discussions that need to be made between the Planning Commission and the City Council and property owners and residents about what residential uses we would prefer to have there, as well as some legal questions of things like, if we allow residential only on the second story, is that really allowed? Can we do that without running afoul of FHA requirements and things like that? So we're trying to straighten out legally what we can do and also what our preferences are for that zone.
Does E mean excluded?
No, an E means exception. Which was a late addition. The feeling on the council was that we'd rather not allow additional banks or credit unions in the commercial zone because they're not sales tax revenue generating, and that is the purpose of the zone. But we wanted to grandfather in our existing bank as well as grandfather in the approved credit union that's not currently pending. That application has exceeded its time limit and they chose not to renew it. But we want to give them the courtesy of coming back with that exact plan if that's what their preference still is. The bank, the credit union now owns that property, purchased it from AmSource. So we want to give them that consideration is the thinking there. We've listed in 3.2 various conditions for residential uses, and the highlight there is second story only, except we're willing to make a trade. Or a condition where if you want to do retail on the southern end of the mixed-use office retail, the blue zone, that a developer would be allowed to put in residential on the ground floor as long as they're building commercial in the other areas at the same time. And there are pretty strict requirements in there that you have to actually build it as 50-50 with commercial coming in at the same time as residential if you're going to do that. We're trying to avoid someone coming in and doing just a purely residential development in a commercial district. There's also some conditions for congregate care that match the conditions we placed on the pending application that's before us. There's some conditions for senior assisted living, a few conditions for retail, and then a catch-all for conditions for all conditional uses. Then I took section 4 and put everything in there that relates to general provisions that don't relate to the building itself, so things like landscaping and streetscaping, which are unchanged from our current requirements and from the document the Planning Commission approved. Sign ordinances stays the same. Parking is nearly the same. I think there's a few minor additions to parking calculations. There is a new section on deliveries to make sure we manage deliveries similar to the Walmart that was approved for delivery hours and screening of the loading dock and noise with the loading dock. And then 4.2 is all about building provisions. It puts all the architectural stuff there. Building height and size is dealt with there. Building setbacks from residential districts that are joining this area, and then a section just on impacts to make sure that we are mitigating any impacts from noise, dust, trash, safety, traffic, and so on. So that's kind of where we're at with the document. I have a list of things that I'm still going to work on, but I figured I want to get this in the Planning Commission's hand as soon as possible. This is the bulk of the changes that are going to be made. There's some less important things like tightening up the language on the architecture to codify some of the practices we've accumulated over the past 20 years so that we have clearer guidance to developers so they're not giving us buildings that look contemporary instead of colonial. And to give them a better sense of exactly what it is we're expecting there. And I'm going to draw from our prior approvals to fill in that section. But otherwise, this is mostly in a state where, and we're going to hand this off to the Planning Commission for the next meeting towards the end of March and have you guys noodle it over and give us recommendations.
Did you say the red boxes with comments in them, are those yours, Daniel?
Those are from Jeff Dodge.
Jeff Dodge.
They're very good.
Oh, okay. I like them.
Yeah. A lot of good ones. So if there are additional comments, I would love to just throw open the floor, especially to our Planning Commission members that are here. If you've read this over and have suggestions of things we ought to work on, I'd love to hear them. I can get some things incorporated before the next Planning Commission meeting and maybe smooth out the process.
I do. I'll go first.
Or do you guys want to talk about things first?
Yeah, go.
You guys go first.
Okay, so a couple of things then, and I'll change a little bit what I said based upon what I just heard from you. The first one is you're kind of identifying parking for the congregate care and assisted living two different places at two different rates. Mm-hmm. You'll want to check that and make sure they are at least consistent with each other or eliminate one of them. For example, in 3.2.2, which occurs twice, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 1, 2, 3. On 1 there, it's 1.4 parking stalls. And then on page 19, section 7, you change that, and it's the way you define how many stalls per unit is different there.
Thank you for catching that.
And the same thing with assisted living. It's just calculated two different ways. And then the other thing that I noticed was building height and size, 4.2.2. You very specifically call out neighborhood retail,
mm-hmm.
and then you do not address the other two districts at all in the remainder of the document for building size or height. That's the only one that's identified by name.
So I believe that in that, yes, and I think we need to double check that. In the section for residential uses, I thought we had indicated, yes, that we have indicated a building size of a certain number of square feet in the conditional use permit for retail and services in the mixed-use office district. So 3.2.3 says building size for uses there is limited to 25,000 square feet.
Yes.
And then in neighborhood retail, it mentions 50,000 square feet.
Yeah, so for size, I'm size. Good. But for heights, but I'm
for,
not
oh,
good.
Oh, for heights, everywhere it's two stories.
But you only say...
And I say that in 4.2.2, which covers everything, which covers all the districts.
But the 35 feet...
The wording is buildings within the neighborhood retail
development. Yes, you're right. That's supposed to be for everything.
That needs to be for all of them.
Yes, thank you. That's for everything. That's a mistake.
That was a big catch on mine. Now, in the prior iteration of this document, there was just massive repetition as they identified each one. I appreciate and approve of the condensation of this.
Yes. And when just I condensed sure that, I accidentally left the neighborhood retail there. Yes, there thank you for catching that.
Okay, and yeah, those
was,
are my...
You could see the cleanup I was trying to do, trying to condense all that
I
stuff.
I appreciate very much what you're doing here.
Yeah.
Very, very much. Those are the primary things I was had on my plate.
This is the beauty of having commissioners here. Thank you, guys.
It's still a fair amount of reading, and there's a lot of wordsmithing going into this. So
you bet.
I applaud the effort.
It's all him.
Daniel, you're doing a good job.
Previously, there wasn't there a reference to decorative cornices or something that could go above 35 feet for certain reasons?
Unoccupied space.
Yeah, is that still?
Features. I don't know. Is that still in there, Daniel?
I think it's been taken out.
I think that's been taken out.
Okay.
The way it's defining the 35 feet, though, is the mid pitch line. Mm. I don't think you would include then decorative cornices or unoccupied.
Right, they could all go up higher.
They could go higher.
Yeah.
Maybe that needs to be clarified.
Should that be clarified?
In our city code, we, for the height, we allow, there's exceptions in residential zones for chimneys and certain things that can go above the pitch line. I think it's up to 10 feet. So we actually do call it out in the city code for these types of things above the allowed height. So in this case, it may maybe serve a purpose to call that out directly.
Yeah, we probably should do something similar.
If you've got an architectural element that just goes up, you know, for instance, I saw a really cool building in Springville the other day. I don't know if anyone's seen it. It's right by the Walmart. But I don't know what it's going to be, but it kind of looks like an old, it's built in a style of an old downtown building. But it's got a huge tower right in the middle of it, and I'm not really sure what it is. Someone told me it's going to be a nice restaurant, but it's really unique. It's kind of, they implemented like a smokestack, but it's all brick, and it goes way tall. I don't exactly know what it's going to do, but it's...
Yeah, so if someone came in...
It's pretty cool.
And
I would say, why would we exclude something like that? And that, it goes way up. It goes up another 20 feet, maybe,
so
on the top of the building.
I mean, this is a good point. If somebody comes in and says, hey, I'm going to build this wonderful restaurant, and oh, by the way, I'm going to put in unoccupied space, 120-foot clock tower...
Right.
Do we want to say no on that? Do we want to put something in the code that says this is how high you can go with decorative elements?
I think we leave that a little bit ambiguous so that we don't limit ourselves to...
But if you're ambiguous, you permit it.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that, especially if it's
architecture. I mean, you could put a limit and occupied. Say 10 feet or 20 feet above the 35 height limit, and then say exceptions may be granted by the Planning Commission with approval
I'm
by
okay
the council, which I've done in other places in the code to make that clear. If you want a variance, you can ask for it.
I'm okay for that.
And the only other thing that I had is in 3.2, when we talk about permitted and conditional uses, I think there's a lot more permitted uses than there were before.
There weren't any permitted uses before.
So a lot more than zero is easy.
One in particular that caused me a little bit of heartburn was the secondhand stores.
Okay.
And antiques and secondhand stores, and there's not any rules around that. So, what's to say that a junk store or thrift store or something, as long as they met the other design criteria, could do that, and that would cause a little concern.
Explain to me the concern there. Is the concern stuff being stored outside the building, or is the concern just it's not a use that you would prefer to have?
Because
we have code elsewhere that says you can't store anything outside.
No, it's not the storage. It's there's quite a few like in downtown AF. There's just junk stores and that kind of thing that would bring maybe less desirable types of traffic and business through, and maybe clarifying that. So,
I mean, a pawn shop is technically a secondhand
right.
junk store.
Isn't pawn shop called out specifically though?
Mm-hmm. Aren't there state rules about pawn shops and
yes.
cash
sure
checking?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that leads me to actually David Shaw.
Yeah.
In a situation like that, would that be considered a retail store where you couldn't say? I mean, what kind of conditions would you put on a specific retail store that is a thrift store, for instance?
No,
that wouldn't be discriminatory.
That's a good question. How can you determine what of their merchandise is palatable to the city and which isn't?
Mm-hmm.
And what of the residents who actually frequent those locations? Are you therefore limiting their ability to shop? And so you have to walk a very fine line in setting up rules that say you can't do that. I mean, you can. So the general rule is always come back to the public health, safety, and welfare. Is it something that violates the public health, That's easy to regulate. Safety, easy to regulate. Welfare, easy to regulate. Anything beyond that gets into the land of discrimination.
So are you saying that if we say this is a commercial zone and we allow some retail uses like sporting goods, bicycles, and toys, that we can't disallow others? And let's just say it's florists. And no. Let's say we just don't mention florists.
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that what you wouldn't be able to do is to say florists can't exist anywhere in the city.
Well, we only have one commercial zone that we're regulating here.
Right. And so so that's why it's...
We don't allow industrial uses anywhere in the city. We don't have an industrial zone.
That's right. And you're not required to have an industrial zone. But when you open it up to a commercial zone, then you open it up to the possibility of some of the less salient uses.
Well, couldn't you just, you're talking about antiques and secondhand, the 5930, just change it from permitted to conditional on both?
Well, that's what I'm saying, yeah. Though, is if...
But you have to have an impact that you're mitigating with conditions.
Yeah, what are the conditions? If you permit it...
Bring it before the Planning Commission and let's impose some conditions on it and staff.
And that's
you know, such as, you know, you can't have, you know, merchandise hanging outside on racks and, you know, or, you know.
Here's a good one with an antique store. You can't have broken up furniture out on the sidewalk sale because it's broken up furniture. It's not a legitimate thing that you're trying to sell, unless maybe it's on a clearance rack. But if all it is a pile of wood, that's not really antique. And so that would be the sort of condition that you might be able to mitigate against.
Well, see, I think we're already
against every type of commercial that meets that same criteria, right? So if you don't, like if it's a secondhand apparel store, you can't have conditions on that that you don't also have on a brand new clothing store.
Yeah, you need to be uniform in that.
Okay.
And so that's where you get into trouble is when you begin to discriminate one against the other based on the type of store that it is, based on the type of goods that they sell. You can impose reasonable conditions, and that's the key. What are the reasonable conditions? And what is it that you're trying to mitigate against?
And we have already language in there that says outside storage of commercial goods and materials is expressly prohibited, so it's not allowed for any use.
That's right.
So what we need to think up is not I prefer that use over this other use if they're both retail, but more what are conditions we can impose that would mitigate any impact.
There are some great secondhand stores that, you know, merchandise very well. So you wouldn't want to exclude those from our community, you know, just because it's a secondhand store. So.
Yeah. Right. I just wanted to make sure that, and maybe we'll discuss this further in Planning Commission, but that had been discussed, that there were some standards, I mean, other than just the design guidelines.
Good point.
Thank you.
Come up with some, I'd love to hear them.
Could we just make them all, instead of putting the P, put the C by them, so they're all conditional?
Sorry, I couldn't.
Could we make those all conditional?
If you can come up with a list of conditions to impose, yes. Because I don't want to have general C's and just say, all these things that we really would prefer not, we're going to put a roadblock in your way by putting a C there and make you come before us, and we may impose whatever conditions we dream up, right?
So each one of these, we're going to have conditions, so that's going to be some additional work that we're going to have to do then before we finalize this?
That's the idea, and so if you look in the document, you'll see there are conditions specifically for residential uses and for congregate care and assisted living, and there's some generic conditions for all retail services in the area in 3.2.3, and then 3.2.4 is a catch-all. So if you feel like a particular use might have things that are in the catch-all, safeguard public health, safety, and general welfare, and you don't know what those are, but you maybe don't anticipate the exact condition, but think maybe there's something related to public health, safety, and welfare, then yeah, we'd put a C on it. So if you think, maybe something with secondhand stores you know, there's some conditions there that I might impose, and I'm not quite sure what they are, but they'd fall under public health, safety, and welfare, then okay, we'd put a C by it.
Like the receipt of furniture, people driving and dropping things off, bed bugs, roaches, exactly. All those
great
things.
Great idea.
Those kinds of things would concern.
Yes.
Yes.
So if there are worries there of that nature, especially if we can codify them, so if you come up with something that's very unique, like people driving and coming up to pick up furniture, we want to make sure that's done safely. Or pests that might be more of a problem because you've got antique furniture and maybe there's greater infestation of pests. I would actually add a section, 3.2.x, and list those conditions that that particular use would then need to meet. That's
this
exactly what we're trying
to do. This may
codify.
Be a dumb question, but can you have some cleanliness guidelines or non-junk,
yes.
Non-junky guidelines?
Yeah, that goes to public health.
Housekeeping.
Yes.
Public health.
Housekeeping, that's a good one.
Yeah, but keep in mind, you're talking about a variety of different stores in this particular category. Anything from the mom-and-pop store that resells Costco returns that they happen to buy, all the way up to something like a Deseret Industries operation. So you have to be a little bit careful to make sure that you're not hitting the one versus the other, and that they're uniform across the board.
And this is why I made a section of uniform requirements that aren't even in the conditional use code. So anything related to noise or dust or odors, I'm not trying to pick on any one use. All uses have to obey that code. And if there are others we need to throw in, such as pests and rodents, which might affect anybody who's storing food,
sure.
Or if there's anything regarding customer pickups, we should just throw those into general requirements rather than trying to make a conditional use permit out of it.
Yeah. One question I have is if we have a category that says permitted, is there a legal basis to then for entity to claim they're excluded from the general overall overarching conditions you have in here that apply to everybody? See what I'm saying? Yeah, but you have conditions in here that are applicable to the entire zone for everybody. But if we say permitted with no conditional use, I'm just, are we saying, yes, you're just permitted, you can come here as long as you're under 50,000 square feet and you have parking? I mean, that's what I'm
saying. So in Section 3, the conditions for conditional uses apply only to conditional uses, but in Section 4 and 5, the requirements, those apply to all uses.
Right, so we're calling those requirements and not conditional uses?
Yeah.
So, okay.
So we've made a change where landscaping is a requirement. Streetscaping is a requirement. Preventing noise from a delivery loading zone is a requirement for any use.
David Schott, I know we've talked about this, but to clarify, basically state code now says a conditional use is in essence a permitted use.
That's right.
You're just putting some conditions on it, but you still have to allow it.
Yeah, conditional use is basically you establishing reasonable conditions that if they meet them, you have to permit it.
Right.
That's you're allowed some flexibility in what you impose there, but it has to be reasonable. It has to be tied to the city's goal and mission, which we've talked quite a bit about, the health, safety, and welfare. And if it doesn't tie back to one of those things, then it's not a legitimate conditional use. Maybe a legitimate permitted use instead. But if you can tie that out, then and they meet the conditions, then you have to permit the application.
And are we on safer ground from litigation standpoint if those conditions are clearly outlined in our code?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And it's also likewise my understanding that someone could come in with a permitted use, say a restaurant, and yet in our requirements, if they somehow don't meet our requirements for trash or dust or odors, we can still turn them down and say you're violating this requirement in our code.
Yeah, that's right, because you've established that clearly as something that they have to do as part of their application. And the trick is you haven't changed the rules on a midstream.
Right.
They knew coming in what the code said. The application process was hopefully clear, and therefore, as they go forward, if they meet the requirements and or the conditional uses, then they are granted the application.
Yeah.
If you change the rules midstream, now you're in big trouble.
So I think this clarifies what David was asking, which is someone comes in and says, hey, I got a permitted use.
Yeah.
So therefore, I can build as close to a residence as I want. And we say, no, no, no. Section 4.2.3 is building setbacks, and right. It replies to everything. It's not a conditional use. It's a requirement. You can only be this close to a residence.
That's right. That's right. And we may need to wordsmith it to interweave those even more. But I think it's covered pretty clearly. So.
Can I go over the list I had?
Yes, please do.
So in page 9, CC&Rs just...
Did you say page 9?
Yeah.
Thank you.
CC&Rs and HOA. I'm not an expert in this area. I just don't know if by requiring or having it be an HOA or CCR, does that discourage developers from coming? I don't know.
That's a good question. I'm not a commercial developer, but... I've never really heard of HOAs or CC&Rs governing commercial zones. Is that?
I think this was just for townhomes and condos within a common area.
It's only for residential uses.
It is
in
the residential use area. I understand that, but I'm just pointing out that some developers may. I don't know. Some developers may look at that situation and say, I'm going to build this place. I have to form an H&A, an HOA, and I don't know if that's. I'm just wondering if there's something there that we may not. Be realizing.
It is a condition we put on Blue Line in our final findings of fact, and it was to make sure that all the things that they said they were going to do, someone's overseeing it and make sure they're actually doing it, not our code enforcement.
So one of the reasons that we're going to have our commercial real estate agent look at this document is to give input on things like this, and so he will.
In bottom of page 9, I understand the concept because I'm supportive of it, but the language in number 2 says that on-site direct services shall be provided directly. Now, the word directly, I think, is where we get a little bit of a hang-up. Directly by the management of the congregate care facility. We're basically asking the people that manage the congregate care facility to essentially be a company that also provides home health care services. And they basically employ qualified professionals to help medications be addressing. I don't have much problem with that, but home health care services as a highly regulated industry to require the management of this congregate care facility also be a home health care company. I think that word directly, I understand what we're trying to accomplish there, but I wonder if we could wordsmith that somehow to, I understand off-site versus on-site premise there, because this should be done on-site, right? You want people there. You want home health care agencies in the building providing services, but to ask a management company to be the expert home health care service company is highly probable.
But isn't that exactly what the Charleston does? Mm-hmm. And so if we're saying that...
But this is congregate care, not assisted living.
You're right. But the city has said that congregate care is substantially the same. So... when I saw this, I thought about that, but I think this is consistent with what we've said in the past. Steve, you want to say something?
My thought on this is there needs to be a clause that they can contract with somebody to provide those on-site services, but it has to be on-site. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the management or ownership that does it, but it has to be done.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Because I'm a contractor.
Are you guys okay with that?
Acme Home Healthcare.
The way you worded it, I think, is the way we want to say it.
The only thing we were trying to avoid was having the situation where they say, yeah, we provide these services because we can call Mary Maids and they can come clean your apartment, and we can call IHC and they can come be your nurse, and we can call Domino's and they can deliver your food, which everybody in their own homes could do, right? And that doesn't make you a congregate care. That's what we were trying to say is what makes you different than just a apartment complex.
I think it says that, but when you add the word directly to it, then you're now requiring that management company to be also the provider, whereas we're not allowing them to contract.
Yeah, but you're I think you're right, but I guess I'm not struggling with that the way you are, because that's exactly what the Charleston does, is that, to my knowledge, they don't contract with anyone. They hire employees to do everything that they're doing. So they have a chef who is hired to be the chef. They have healthcare workers that are hired by the Charleston, as opposed to working with third-party companies. So
the Charleston does have private nurses that come in.
Yeah, and they have private hospice too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
there's
good
outside,
to know.
There's outside companies coming in to serve patients.
And so I might suggest either directly or under contract with qualified third-party vendors or contractors.
That may be the better wordsmithing.
Yeah, and the key is the qualified.
And the on-site's really important to keep, too.
Did someone already catch that it goes from number 5 to number 1 and
yeah.
starts over? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Anyway, that word directly just kind of legalese, you know, just kind of ties that little there.
Thank you so much for
Thank
coming.
You. Thank you.
I should have bumped you guys up to the first one.
Well, I think Charles said in the last meeting the whole time there was about 3 weeks of vacation, right? So.
Do you have anything else, David?
I do.
Keep on going.
Number 3, each resident shall be age of 55 years or older. I get that. I understand that. I believe that's contrary to the HOPA law that permits 20% of the residents to not be 55 or older. So this might be contrary to federal statute, the way it's worded.
And we'll be looking at that.
Okay.
I think in the HOPA laws, the city can be more restrictive than 80, the 80-20 split. They can do a higher requirement based on what I've read. But we will look at that.
I don't think it's a violation, because these are the same restrictions we put on Blue Line, which was reviewed by the land use attorneys quite in depth.
Yeah, we're just going to look at it.
Okay.
One more time.
On that same page, number 2, number where it goes 1, 2, 3 again. Mm-hmm. Storage of RVs, motorhomes, trailers, boats. I don't know. I get that as well. I agree that we don't want anything stored there, but are we going to allow them to be on site ever? You know, Aunt Nellie comes to visit in the RV.
I think storage means more than 48 hours. I think our code.
Right. So I think we just define what, how long is storage? When does it become storage versus, you know, parking a boat because you're having lunch with your
family? That's a good question. We'll noodle that over, and hopefully you guys do too.
Good point. That's why there's Walmart parking lot for the RVs to go.
No, yeah. I was going to say, I think we excluded that, didn't we, from our Walmart parking
lot?
Yeah,
but nobody does. I mean,
yeah.
Ours is good, but most of the Walmarts around the country are
so we should
havens
use,
for RV
yeah.
parking.
We should use the same language that we use for Walmart.
There. And Walmart loves that.
No, Walmart doesn't really care.
It's part of their business model.
Yeah. Page 12, 4.12, landscaping. All planters shall receive a 3-inch depth of shredded fir bark. I don't know if that's supposed to be some fir bark. I don't know. Fir bark. But my point actually is not the spelling. It's the all planters shall receive a 3-inch depth. Maybe it should be all planters shall receive and maintain a 3-inch depth, so they don't just do it one time. They actually have to maintain their bark, not just one time.
What happens if they want to use, like, stone, which is a preferable product, in my opinion, because fir bark, the first wind, and it's down in their parking lot.
True.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to say, or other...
well, part of xeriscape.
Planter, you know, materials.
Yeah.
I mean... I personally can't stand bark. I mean, I put it in my yard every once in a while.
Right.
And the first one comes along, it's in my neighbor's yard.
Right.
And my neighbor's in my yard, all over my walkways and everything.
Right. That's what required now, the fir bark?
It's been there for a long time. If you use big enough chunks, it doesn't blow away. I figured
it
this out.
It still does. I've tried all kinds of
At least on mine it doesn't. And I get a lot of wind. But, you know, I guess I'm less of a fan of the rock. but I think we should discuss this and come up with something reasonable.
Page 14.
Hasn't Walmart started using Rock over there now? And if some of their planners?
Well, and this is a good question for legal. How do you actually enforce that over time?
Well, Walmart's park is now dirt. You walk through their former park.
It's all blown away.
It's just all blown away.
I thought they started replacing it with some rock, though, but maybe I haven't looked at it.
Yeah, this becomes an issue for our code enforcement person to potentially watch, especially if you're concerned about it.
Do you know, Jeff, have you noticed recently?
Yeah, they've changed
some. Some of it's been changed to rock, hasn't it?
Yeah. There is some rock because I remember I just shopped there last week and I was walking through.
I walked through one of them.
A lot of the rocks were in the parking they had knocked down. People walked through there and knocked them down. Now the rocks are sitting there where you park.
That was a really big wind.
Huh?
It was a really big wind.
It's called kids.
Yeah. I would say a lot of the kids coming from Lone Peak are kicking it around as well. Yeah.
Keep going, David.
So, page 14, number 3, fountains, plazas, and splash pads shall be included in the site design. Are we really going to ask them to do all three of those? Or we want them to pick one of the three? Or
they may be. What? Maybe I need to change that to may be included as opposed to shall be included.
I think it's probably may.
The idea there is if you're going to put one in, put it in the site design so we can see where it is.
Or change the word and or, like make them put one of those three in, like fountain plazas or splash pads should be included.
Yes.
Instead of and make
or something like that, or contemplate it to be in the site design or, proposed shall be included in the site design.
Yeah, proposed fountains, plazas, and splash pads shall
I'll point out just kind of. The irony here after our water discussion is now we're encouraging fountains and splash pads.
That's our recirculating water, though.
So it still evaporates.
Yeah.
True.
What do you think of the 5% reduction in landscaping requirement? We're trying to put an incentive there that actually would provide public gathering places that can be usable. So this is a new thing. I promise to point out new things as we go along.
Yeah.
I like it just because I know residents have said over and over again that that's one thing that they want for our commercial zone is a community gathering place.
I guess the question would be is what landscaping requirements do we allow them to
use? Yeah, that's how do you define whatever? What's the requirement? The size?
Yeah.
Or the amount of trees? What's the reduction? Size?
It's percentage of land that needs to be covered by the landscaping.
Okay, then I think you need to define that.
5% reduction in
landscaping
area or something.
Area requirements.
Area requirements. That's what the intention was there.
Thank you.
I mean, the other question would be, so, okay, you go to smaller caliper trees, so their landscaping budget goes down.
Yeah, thank you.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So on page 21... and I've already made comment on this, and I'm not advocating this, but I'm just pointing out my personal recollection experience in regards to building stories, 1, 2, or 3, during all the public hearings and comments that we had, it seemed to me that most of the public seemed palatable to a 3-story building. I know that's contrary to what some of you have heard, and I have heard people say they didn't want a 3-story building. I'm just saying generally, overall, if you take all the multitude of comments combined, it seemed that when a project was originally proposed at 5 and then 4 and it became 3 seemed to be the point where the public could get behind it a little bit. So I'm just pointing out, and I don't know, when we say 2 stories, period, again, is that something that would chase away developers? I don't know. I'm not a developer, so I'm just, we'll have some level of concern that when we prohibit a 3rd story, we're going to have a lot of people coming and desiring 3rd stories, just constantly saying no.
I think we asked that of our professional.
Yeah, so I think. Wasn't that in our survey?
No.
No? Okay.
I think you raise a good point. I'm not a commercial developer, but I don't know if that would turn me away. On the other hand.
Our commercial agent will weigh in on all of this, so any questions?
I would like that out. Just to get his opinion.
I think, though, if you are limiting it to 35 feet, can you really do more than 2 stories with commercial floors?
Well, I think the thinking here is that you might have 1 story of commercial and then 2 stories above it of residential. So it would allow you to stack up the residential
about it. I like that option to be still out there.
I don't know, for developers, is it cheaper to build a third story than in two stories? Is it change either? I have no idea. I'm just throwing out there that that's all the comments I had.
Okay. Thank you, David.
Okay. Any other questions?
I think my biggest question for the council is, if you look at the survey results, let me pull them up here. And we talked about residential uses. We have residents that are mostly comfortable with residential uses in both parts of the commercial zone. But I'm wondering, and it's been part of our commercial zone for a long time, there were a lot of residents who leaned towards zero in the neighborhood retail, and I lean that way personally. So my question is, do we even want to mess around with residential in the neighborhood retail section? Would we rather just say, you know what, no residential there and make our lives easier?
It doesn't bother me to have residential there if it's restricted to the second floor and we have an overall density limitation.
Which is what we have now.
I think I'd go along with you, Daniel.
What's that?
I think I'd go along with that.
You'd go along with
none? With none.
No residential, yeah.
I'd go along with that.
Can I ask one more question about the traffic study
Absolutely.
Station?
Go right ahead.
Was that, where did that come from? Is that...
Jenny could answer that one.
Wait, where are we?
The traffic study
traffic
section.
Traffic studies.
Where did that come from?
Remind me, where is it?
It's
page
in
it's page 23 of 24.
23 and
24. It's six.
There you go. Right
basically here. Six.
Oh, this one came... I want to say Pleasant Grove, but I'd have to go look and back up my notes. It was either Pleasant Grove or St. George. I think it was Pleasant Grove, but I can double check on my notes and let you know.
Okay. Well, my only thought on that one briefly is, so we've established a commercial zone already, right? Mm-hmm. And we've established certain uses in that zone that allow all kinds of traffic to run up and down Cedar Hills Drive, 4800 West. We've done a traffic study that says this is sufficient for the commercial traffic that we're expecting in this area. Why are we then imposing another study on the developers? And maybe that's a question for David and Chandler.
I think we're just trying to consolidate what these traffic conditions are or what the requirements are.
I mean, what happens if a conditional use comes along, like say a restaurant, and it's a very popular restaurant, right?
That's a permitted use, but yeah, go ahead.
Is it permitted?
Yeah.
All restaurants are exactly permitted?
Yeah.
Okay, well, under this...
But they still need to do a traffic study.
Right, well, why?
Doesn't traffic change over time?
Yes, but in our city's planning and zoning and long-term planning, general plan... We have designated this as commercial. The only way to improve the commercial or the traffic would be to widen streets.
So I think because this covers the entire commercial zone,
because this use creates that much more traffic, you're excluded. I'm sorry. You can never get – what if it creates a D zone because of what they're predicting –
So I think
it could never come there, and it could be the best thing that we could ever have in Cedar Hills. I mean, that's what I'm saying.
I understand. I know where you're coming from. I think my concern is particularly with the portion of the commercial zone that is closer to residents, so the mixed-use area. So as they're coming out a driveway across from the Charleston, if somebody comes along and says, I'm going to dump a ton of traffic onto 4600 West, which is more of a collector street, and they turn that into a level D, I think residents would be unhappy with that as opposed to 4800 West, where they'd have less concern.
Well, I understand that for uses like congregate care and assisted living. But when it comes to commercial, yeah. Just
so you're
the general...
you this only on certain areas or for certain uses?
I would say, in my opinion, yes. I mean, I'm just asking... I'm throwing that out.
So maybe we say if you anticipate having more than 500 average daily trips, then you should do a traffic study.
I don't know what the number is. I'm not a traffic engineer, so I don't know what the number
1,000,
is.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. I would ask that of David and Chandler. To me, an individual traffic study seems excessive. When we've already established this is a commercial zone.
The only thing I think it could impact is it can help us define that if you're going to have, if the traffic's going to affect the nearby community this much, then we're going to require you to put in that additional street or additional entrances and exits or whatever the case is. We're not going to just allow you to all filter through that current.
But I'm sorry, we don't have the ability to do that. There's only a couple places where you can enter and exit.
We do have
that
one
fall within our.
We do have one ability that would affect the neighborhood retail, which is that new street that's going to come through. Mm-hmm. And we've had some developers come and approach us and say, "I'm just going to put in a development right there, and I'm not going to put that street through. I'm going to put in a cul-de-sac, and you know that might not work from a traffic standpoint."
Yeah, but they would still have to put in some entrances into the parking lot. Maybe not a through street, but a...
Yeah, but they may have designed it so poorly, and this would allow us to find out that, oh, you know, that's a really bad design. You should put the street all the way through.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, what if the... I'm playing the devil's advocate on this.
There is something they can do. They can put 4700 West through, and we can require them to do that if a traffic study says they need to.
But I think 4700 is already established as a right-of-way.
I mean, it's established in our general plan, but I don't think there's anything to require that to go through unless we tell them that you need it for traffic purposes. Unless you want to put it into our zone and say there shall be a street here,
well,
no matter what.
What's the street north of Hearts?
That's 4700 West. That's what I'm talking about.
No, it's on the north side.
Oh,
on
north
the
north of Hearts. Side, yeah.
10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10
one you're talking about.
Yeah.
But that's already established. That's going to be a road.
Well, we hope, but we don't know for sure.
We don't
well,
know
half
for sure.
of it's been built, so. Right?
Yes.
Not all the way down past Hearts and down towards the mortuary.
No, and maybe that area doesn't need it.
The traffic study would let us know.
By the way, just as an aside, an unintended traffic flow consequence of the new Dollar Tree, I found myself being tempted to drive from Hearts through there to Walmart.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yes.
I don't think that was the intent of that. I don't think it was designed for that kind of flow.
I don't think it wasn't designed not to do that, so I don't think that's horrible.
It was designed with the intent that street was going to go all the way through to the mortuary, but that may be
well, potentially time. Through there. I mean, no one's really ever proposed it other than Blue Line originally, right?
I think in the original general plan that we had put together for that I saw a long time ago, it went through.
Yes.
Master plan.
Yes. Master plan, sorry. Yes.
It shows it going through.
I think Mike's point is that our commercial zone should be established in such a way that we can accommodate the most popular of
that's exactly my point.
The traffic study has already been done, right?
And so we've right.
already established that we can handle the most intense traffic situation that maybe we can imagine.
With the exception of maybe assisted living, congregate care, those things that were very were conditional under our old.
So maybe we should draw in 4700 West and declare that it shall be there unless there is approval from the council predicated on a traffic study. So in other words, if you're going to change our master plan.
Was 4700 included in the original traffic study that was done for our commercial zone?
Yeah, that's a master plan road.
Course. Okay, then if that's the case,
so if we say if you're going
to make
go
changes
our,
to that,
yes.
then would require a traffic study, which I would agree with.
In fact, all the design work that we've done so far requires that road to have a certain curve to it as it comes from Cedar Hills Drive going south, so that it hits the intersection between Hearts and AmSource and the Smart property. That intersection right there is split.
Mm-hmm. So then I would agree with that if we deviate from, you know, our current established commercial traffic study, then
we'll
supplemental go. Traffic study would be required.
Yeah. It would be more along the line of the master plan. We didn't do a traffic study because traffic studies typically you need the use, and we didn't know the use. Yeah. We don't know the use
and
yet.
We don't. But we are saying any commercial use should be accommodated by our traffic.
But I agree with you in the fact that the commercial zone is what it is. I think a traffic study is good to show ingress and egress and the number of vehicles that are going to be entering that system, that street system. But are we going to widen Cedar Hills Drive? No.
No.
I don't anticipate that we will. Now, we have a really strange phenomenon that Daniel and Chandler and I talked about this. Our PKM time is reflective of the high school, not of anything that we anticipate in the commercial
zone. I know. That's part of the problem.
And so really, the road system that's down there is going to be what we have. 4800 West, I do not anticipate ever getting wider than 5 lanes. And, you know, from all projections that we can see, even with Alpine getting built out, that 5-lane road will handle, including our commercial zone, will handle.
You mean Highland across the street being built out?
Alpine, because Alpine's sending their flow, you know, south.
Oh, Alpine being built. I see. Yeah.
So my concern, as far as changes that might need to be made, is you could look at the intersection of 4700 West with Cedar Hills Drive and see that that's becoming a problem, especially during peak times. If you try to come out of Walmart and turn left on Cedar Hills Drive, you might be waiting for a while to get through there. That would be an area where if somebody came in with a high use development and it's going to really impact that intersection, I might say, you know what? Maybe we need to put a roundabout there so that you actually get that traffic flowing better regardless of which direction you're coming from.
A roundabout on 4800?
4700 and Cedar Hills Drive.
Oh, yeah. Perhaps. Could be. But do we have the right-of-way there either? I don't know if we do or not. Anyway.
Are you good?
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay. All right. Any further comments, questions? Not, I think that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here, especially our commissioners that were here and their input. We always appreciate that. So I will take a motion to adjourn.
I move that we adjourn.
I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We are done. Thank you very much.